the second armistice at Compiègne. I followed the German army into Paris that June, always the loveliest of months in the majestic capital, which was now stricken, and on June 19th got wind of where Hitler was going to lay down his terms for the armistice which Pétain had requested 2 days before. It was to be on the same spot where the German Empire had capitulated to France and her allies on November 11, 1918, in the little clearing in the woods at Compiègne. There the Nazi warlord would get his revenge, and the place itself would add to the sweetness of it for him. On May 20th, a bare 10 days after the great offensive in the West had started, and on the day the German tanks reached Abbeville, the idea had come to him. Jodl noted it in his diary that day. "Führer is working on the peace treaty, first negotiations in the forest of Compiègne." Late on the afternoon of June 19th, I drove out there and found German army engineers demolishing the wall of the museum where the old wagon-lit of Marshal Foch, in which the 1918 armistice was signed, had been preserved. By the time I left, the engineers, working with pneumatic drills, had torn the wall down and were pulling the car out to the tracks in the center of the clearing on the exact spot, they said, where it had stood at 5 a.m. on November 11, 1918, when at the dictation of Foch, the German emissaries put their signatures to the armistice. And so it was that on the afternoon of June 21st, I stood by the edge of the forest at Compiègne to observe the latest and greatest of Hitler's triumphs, of which, in the course of my work, I had seen so many over the last turbulent years. It was one of the loveliest summer days I ever remember in France. A warm June sun beat down on the stately trees, elms, oaks, cypresses, and pines, casting pleasant shadows on the wooded avenues leading to the little circular clearing. At 3:15 p.m. precisely, Hitler arrived in his big Mercedes, accompanied by Göring, Brauchitsch, Keitel, Raeder, Ribbentrop, and Hess, all in their various uniforms, and Göring, the lone field marshal of the Reich, fiddling with his field marshal's baton. They alighted from their automobiles some 200 yards away in front of the Alsace-Lorraine statue, which was draped with German war flags, so that the Führer could not see, though I remembered from previous visits in happier days, the large sword, the sword of the victorious Allies of 1918, sticking through a limp eagle representing the German Empire of the Hohenzollerns. Hitler glanced at the monument and strode on. "I observed his face," I wrote in my diary. "It was grave, solemn, yet brimming with revenge. There was also in it, as in his springy step, a note of the triumphant conqueror, the defier of the world. There was something else, a sort of scornful inner joy at being present at this great reversal of fate, a reversal he himself had wrought." When he reached the little opening in the forest, and his personal standard had been run up in the center of it, his attention was attracted by a great granite block which stood some 3 feet above the ground. Hitler, followed by the others, walks slowly over to it, I am quoting my diary, steps up, and reads the inscription engraved, in French, in great high letters. "Here on the 11th of November 1918 succumbed the criminal pride of the German Empire, vanquished by the free peoples which it tried to enslave." Hitler reads it, and Göring reads it. They all read it, standing there in the June sun and the silence. I look for the expression in Hitler's face. I am but 50 yards from him, and see him through my glasses as though he were directly in front of me. I have seen that face many times at the great moments of his life, but today it is afire with scorn, anger, hate, revenge, triumph. He steps off the monument and contrives to make even this gesture a masterpiece of contempt. He glances back at it, contemptuous, angry. Angry, you almost feel, because he cannot wipe out the awful, provoking lettering with one sweep of his high Prussian boot. It was blown up 3 days later at Hitler's command. He glances slowly around the clearing, and now, as his eyes meet ours, you grasp the depth of his hatred. But there is triumph there, too. Revengeful, triumphant hate. Suddenly, as though his face were not giving quite complete expression to his feelings, he throws his whole body into harmony with his mood. He swiftly snaps his hands on his hips, arches his shoulders, plants his feet wide apart. It is a magnificent gesture of defiance, a burning contempt for this place now and all that it has stood for in the 22 years since it witnessed the humbling of the German Empire. Hitler and his party then entered the armistice railway car, the Führer seating himself in the chair occupied by Foch in 1918. 5 minutes later, the French delegation arrived, headed by General Charles Unziger, commander of the Second Army at Sedan, and made up of an admiral, an Air Force general, and one civilian, Léon Noël, the former ambassador to Poland, who was now witnessing his second debacle wrought by German arms. They looked shattered, but retained a tragic dignity. They had not been told that they would be led to this proud French shrine to undergo such a humiliation, and the shock was no doubt just what Hitler had calculated. As Halder wrote in his diary that evening after being given an eyewitness account by Brauchitsch, the French had no warning that they would be handed the terms at the very site of the negotiations in 1918. They were apparently shaken by this arrangement and at first inclined to be sullen. Perhaps it was natural, even for a German so cultivated as Halder or Brauchitsch, to mistake solemn dignity for sullenness. The French, one saw at once, were certainly dazed. Yet contrary to the reports at the time, they tried, as we now know from the official German minutes of the meetings found among the captured Nazi secret papers, to soften the harsher portions of the Führer's terms and to eliminate those which they thought were dishonorable. But they tried in vain. Hitler and his entourage left the wagon-lit as soon as General Keitel had read the preamble of the armistice terms to the French, leaving the negotiations in the hands of his OKW chief, but allowing him no leeway in departing from the conditions which he himself had laid down. Unziger told the Germans at once, as soon as he had read them, that they were hard and merciless, much worse than those which France had handed Germany here in 1918. Moreover, if another country beyond the Alps, which had not defeated France, Unziger was too contemptuous of Italy even to name her, advanced similar demands, France would in no circumstances submit. She would fight to the bitter end. It was therefore impossible for him to put his signature to the German armistice agreement. General Jodl, the number two officer at OKW, who presided temporarily at this moment, had not expected such defiant words from a hopelessly beaten foe, and replied that though he could not help express his understanding for what Unziger had said about the Italians, nevertheless he had no power to change the Führer's terms. All he could do, he said, was to give explanations and clear up obscure points. The French would have to take the armistice document or leave it as it was. The Germans had been annoyed that the French delegation had arrived without authority to conclude an armistice except with the express agreement of the government at Bordeaux. By a miracle of engineering, and perhaps with some luck, they succeeded in setting up a telephone connection from the old sleeping car right through the battle lines, where the fighting still continued, to Bordeaux. The French delegates were authorized to use it to transmit the text of the armistice terms and to discuss it with their government. Dr. Schmidt, who served as interpreter, was directed to listen in on the tapped conversations from an army communications van a few yards away behind a clump of trees. The next day, I myself contrived to hear the German recording of part of the conversation between Unziger and General Weygand. To the credit of the latter, who bears a grave responsibility for French defeatism and the final surrender and the break with Britain, it must be recorded that he at least strenuously objected to many of the German demands. One of the most odious of them obligated the French to turn over to the Reich all anti-Nazi German refugees in France and in her territories. Weygand called this dishonorable, in view of the French tradition of the right of asylum, but when it was discussed the next day, the arrogant Keitel would not listen to its being deleted. The German émigrés, he shouted, were the greatest warmongers. They had betrayed their own people. They must be handed over at all costs. The French made no protest against a clause which stated that all their nationals caught fighting with another country against Germany would be treated as francs-tireurs, that is, immediately shot. This was aimed against de Gaulle, who was already trying to organize a free French force in Britain, and both Weygand and Keitel knew it was a crude violation of the primitive rules of war. Nor did the French question a paragraph which provided for all prisoners of war to remain in captivity until the conclusion of peace. Weygand was sure the British would be conquered within 3 weeks, and the French POWs thereafter released. Thus he condemned 1.5 million Frenchmen to war prison camps for 5 years. The crux of the armistice treaty was the disposal of the French navy. Churchill, as France tottered, had offered to release her from her pledge not to make a separate peace if the French navy were directed to sail for British ports. Hitler was determined that this should not take place. He fully realized, as he told Mussolini on June 18th, that it would immeasurably strengthen Britain. With so much at stake, he had to make a concession, or at least a promise, to the beaten foe. The armistice agreement stipulated that the French fleet would be demobilized and disarmed, and the ships laid up in their home ports. In return for this, the German government solemnly declares to the French government that it does not intend to use for its own purposes in the war the French fleet which is in ports under German supervision. Furthermore, they solemnly and expressly declare that they have no intention of raising any claim to the French war fleet at the time of the conclusion of peace. Like almost all of Hitler's promises, this one too would be broken. Finally, Hitler left the French government an unoccupied zone in the south and southeast in which it ostensibly was free to govern. This was an astute move. It would not only divide France itself geographically and administratively, it would make difficult, if not impossible, the formation of a French government in exile, and quash any plans of the politicians in Bordeaux to move the seat of government to French North Africa, a design which almost succeeded, being defeated in the end not by the Germans but by the French defeatists, Pétain, Weygand, Laval, and their supporters. Moreover, Hitler knew that the men who had now seized control of the French government at Bordeaux were enemies of French democracy and might be expected to be cooperative in helping him set up the Nazi New Order in Europe. Yet on the second day of the armistice negotiations at Compiègne, the French delegates continued to bicker and delay. One reason for the delay was that Unziger insisted that Weygand give him not an authorization to sign, but an order. No one in France wanted to take the responsibility. Finally, at 6:30 p.m., Keitel issued an ultimatum. The French must accept or reject the German armistice terms within an hour. Within the hour, the French government capitulated. At 6:50 p.m. on June 22, 1940, Unziger and Keitel signed the armistice treaty. It was stipulated that it would go into effect as soon as the Franco-Italian armistice was signed, and that hostilities would cease 6 hours after that event. I listened to the last scene as it was picked up by the hidden microphones in the wagon-lit. Just before he signed, the French general, his voice quivering, said he wished to make a personal statement. I took it down in French as he spoke. I declare that the French government has ordered me to sign these terms of armistice. Forced by the fate of arms to cease the struggle in which we were engaged on the side of the Allies, France sees imposed on her very hard conditions. France has the right to expect in the future negotiations that Germany show a spirit which will permit the two great neighboring countries to live and work in peace. Those negotiations, for a peace treaty, would never take place, but the spirit which the Nazi Third Reich would have shown, if they had, soon became evident as the occupation became harsher and the pressure on the servile Pétain regime increased. France was now destined to become a German vassal, as Pétain, Weygand, and Laval apparently believed, and accepted. A light rain began to fall as the delegates left the armistice car and drove away. Down the road through the woods you could see an unbroken line of refugees making their way home on weary feet, on bicycles, on carts, a few fortunate ones on old trucks. I walked out to the clearing. A gang of German army engineers, shouting lustily, had already started to move the old wagon-lit. "Where to?" I asked. "To Berlin," they said. It arrived there July 8th. Ironically, it was destroyed in an Allied bombing of Berlin later in the war. The Franco-Italian armistice was signed in Rome 2 days later. Mussolini was able to occupy only what his troops had conquered, which meant a few hundred yards of French territory, and to impose a 50-mile demilitarized zone opposite him in France and Tunisia. The armistice was signed at 7:35 p.m. on June 24th. 6 hours later, the guns in France lapsed into silence. France, which had held out unbeaten for 4 years the last time, was out of the war after 6 weeks. German troops stood guard over most of Europe, from the North Cape above the Arctic Circle to Bordeaux, from the English Channel to the River Bug in eastern Poland. Adolf Hitler had reached the pinnacle. The former Austrian waif, who had been the first to unite the Germans in a truly national state, this corporal of the First World War, had now become the greatest of German conquerors. All that stood between him and the establishment of German hegemony in Europe under his dictatorship was one indomitable Englishman, Winston Churchill, and the determined people Churchill led, who did not recognize defeat when it stared them in the face, and who now stood alone, virtually unarmed, their island home besieged by the mightiest military machine the world had ever seen. Hitler plays for peace. 10 days after the German onslaught on the West began, on the evening German tanks reached Abwehr, General Jodl, after describing in his diary how the Führer was beside himself with joy, added, "is working on the peace treaty. Britain can get a separate peace any time after restitution of the colonies." That was May 20th. For several weeks thereafter, Hitler seems to have had no doubts that, with France knocked out, Britain would be anxious to make peace. His terms, from the German point of view, seemed most generous, considering the beating the British had taken in Norway and in France. He had expounded them to General von Rundstedt on May 24th, expressing his admiration of the British Empire and stressing the necessity for its existence. All he wanted from London, he said, was a free hand on the continent. So certain was he that the British would agree to this that even after the fall of France he made no plans for continuing the war against Britain. And the vaunted General Staff, which supposedly planned with Prussian thoroughness for every contingency, far in advance, did not bother to furnish him any. Halder, the chief of the General Staff, made no mention of the subject at this time in his voluminous diary entries. He was more disturbed about Russian threats in the Balkans and the Baltic than about the British. Indeed, why should Great Britain fight on alone against helpless odds, especially when it could get a peace that would leave it, unlike France, Poland, and all the other defeated lands, unscathed, intact, and free? This was a question asked everywhere, except in Downing Street, where, as Churchill later revealed, it was never even discussed, because the answer was taken for granted. But the German dictator did not know this, and when Churchill began to state it publicly that Britain was not quitting, Hitler apparently did not believe it. Not even when on June 4th, after the evacuation from Dunkirk, the Prime Minister had made his resounding speech about fighting on in the hills and on the beaches. Not even when on June 18th, after Pétain had asked for an armistice, Churchill reiterated in the Commons Britain's inflexible resolve to continue the war, and in another one of his eloquent and memorable perorations concluded, "Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duties, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will say this was their finest hour." These could be merely soaring words from a gifted orator, and so Hitler, a dazzling orator himself, must have thought. He must have been encouraged, too, by soundings in neutral capitals and by the appeals for ending the war that now emanated from them. On June 28th, a confidential message arrived for Hitler from the Pope. Analogous communications were addressed to Mussolini and Churchill, offering his mediation for a just and honorable peace, and declaring that before initiating this step he wished to ascertain confidentially how it would be received. The King of Sweden was also active in proposing peace to both London and Berlin. In the United States, the German embassy, under the direction of Hans Thompson, the chargé d'affaires, was spending every dollar it could lay its hands on to support the isolationists in keeping America out of the war and thus discourage Britain from continuing it. The captured Foreign Office documents are full of messages from Thompson reporting on the embassy's efforts to sway American public opinion in Hitler's favor. The party conventions were being held that summer, and Thompson was bending every effort to influence their foreign policy planks, especially that of the Republicans. On June 12th, for example, he cabled Berlin in code, "Most urgent, top secret, that a well-known Republican congressman, who was working closely with the German embassy, had offered for $3,000 to invite 50 isolationist Republican congressmen to the Republican convention so that they may work on the delegates in favor of an isolationist foreign policy." The same individual, Thompson reported, wanted $30,000 to help pay for full-page advertisements in the American newspapers to be headed "Keep America Out of the War." Such an advertisement appeared in the New York Times, June 25, 1940. The next day, Thompson was wiring Berlin about a new project he said he was negotiating through an American literary agent to have 5 well-known American writers write books, from which I await great results. For this project he needed $20,000, a sum Ribbentrop okayed a few days later. By July 5, 1940, Thompson had become so apprehensive about his payments that he cabled Berlin for permission to destroy all receipts and accounts. The payments are made to the recipients through trusted go-betweens, but in the circumstances, it is obvious that no receipts can be expected. Such receipts or memoranda would fall into the hands of the American Secret Service if the embassy were suddenly to be seized by American authorities, and despite all camouflage, by the fact of their existence alone, they would mean political ruin and have other grave consequences for our political friends, who are probably known to our enemies. I therefore request that the embassy be authorized to destroy these receipts and statements, and henceforth dispense with making them, as also with keeping accounts of such payments. This telegraphic report has been destroyed. One of Hitler's first public utterances about his hopes for peace with Britain had been given Karl von Wiegand, a Hearst correspondent, and published in the New York Journal American on June 14th. A fortnight later, Thompson informed the German Foreign Office that he had printed 100,000 extra copies of the interview, and that, "I was able furthermore, through a confidential agent, to induce the isolationist representative Thorkelson, Republican of Montana, to have the Führer interview inserted in the Congressional Record of June 22nd. This assures the interview once more the widest distribution." The Nazi embassy in Washington grasped at every straw. At one point during the summer, its press attaché was forwarding what he said was a suggestion of Fulton Lewis Jr., the radio commentator, whom he described as an admirer of Germany and the Führer and a highly respected American journalist. The Führer should address telegrams to Roosevelt, reading approximately as follows. "You, Mr. Roosevelt, have repeatedly appealed to me and always expressed the wish that a sanguinary war be avoided. I did not declare war on England. On the contrary, I always stressed that I did not wish to destroy the British Empire. My repeated requests to Churchill to be reasonable and to arrive at an honorable peace treaty were stubbornly rejected by Churchill. I am aware that England will suffer severely when I order total war to be launched against the British Isles. I ask you, therefore, to approach Churchill on your part and prevail upon him to abandon his senseless obstinacy." Lewis added that Roosevelt would, of course, make a rude and spiteful reply. That would make no difference. Such an appeal would surely make a profound impression on the North American people, and especially in South America. Adolf Hitler did not take Mr. Lewis's purported advice, but the Foreign Office in Berlin cabled to ask how important the radio commentator was in America. Thompson replied that Lewis had enjoyed a particular success of late, but that, on the other hand, in contrast to some leading American commentators, no political importance is to be attached to L. The doings of the German embassy in Washington at this period, as disclosed in its own dispatches, which are published in Documents on German Foreign Policy, would furnish the material for a revealing book. One is struck by the tendency of the German diplomats to tell the Nazi dictator pretty much what he wanted to hear, a practice common among representatives of totalitarian lands. Two officers of OKW told me in Berlin that the high command, or at least the general staff, was highly suspicious of the objectivity of the reports from the Washington embassy, and that they had established their own military intelligence in the United States. They were not served very well by General Friedrich von Boedeker, the German military attaché in Washington, if one can judge by his dispatches included in the DGFP volumes. He never tired of warning OKW and the general staffs of the Army and Air Force to whom his messages were addressed, that America was controlled by the Jews and the Freemasons, which was exactly what Hitler thought. Boedeker also overestimated the influence of the isolationists in American politics, especially of Colonel Charles A. Lindbergh, who emerges in his dispatches as his great hero. An extract or two indicates the tenor of his reports. July 20, 1940. As the exponents of the Jews, who especially through Freemasonry control the broad masses of the American people, Roosevelt wants England to continue fighting and the war to be prolonged. The circle about Lindbergh has become aware of this development and now tries at least to impede the fatal control of American policy by the Jews. I have repeatedly reported on the mean and vicious campaign against Lindbergh, whom the Jews fear as their most potent adversary. DGFP, Volume 10, pages 254 to 255. August 6, 1940. The background of Lindbergh's reemergence in public and the campaign against him. The Jewish element now controls key positions in the American Armed Forces, after having in the last weeks filled the posts of Secretary of War, Assistant Secretary of War, and Secretary of the Navy with subservient individuals, and attached a leading and very influential Jew, Colonel Julius Ox Adler, as Secretary to the Secretary of War. The forces opposing the Jewish element and the present policy of the United States have been mentioned in my reports, taking account also of the importance of the General Staff. The greatly gifted Lindbergh, whose connections reach very far, is much the most important of them all. The Jewish element and Roosevelt fear the spiritual and particularly the moral superiority and purity of this man. On Sunday, August 4th, Lindbergh delivered a blow that will hurt the Jews. He stressed that America should strive for sincere collaboration with Germany, with a view to peace and the preservation of Western culture. Several hours later, the aged General Pershing, who has long been a puppet in the hands of Roosevelt, which means of the Jews, read over the radio a declaration, foisted upon him by the wire pullers, to the effect that America would be imperiled by England's defeat. The chorus of the Jewish element casting suspicion on Lindbergh in the press, and his denunciation by a Senator Lucas, who spoke against Lindbergh over the radio Monday night at Roosevelt's behest as a fifth columnist, that is, a traitor, merely served to underline the fear of the spiritual power of this man, about whose progress I have reported since the beginning of the war, and in whose great importance for future German-American relations I believe. DGFP, Volume 10, pages 413 to 415. On September 18th, Thompson, in a further report, gave an account of a confidential conversation he said had taken place between Lindbergh and several American General Staff officers. Lindbergh gave it as his opinion that England would soon collapse before German air attacks. The General Staff officers, however, held that Germany's air strength was not sufficient to force a decision. DGFP, Volume 10, pages 413 to 415. On October 19, 1938, 3 weeks after Munich, Lindbergh had been awarded and had accepted the Service Cross of the German Eagle with Star. This was, I believe, the second highest German decoration, usually conferred on distinguished foreigners who, in the official words of the citations, deserved well of the Reich. Churchill himself, as he related later in his memoirs, was somewhat troubled by the peace feelers emanating through Sweden, the United States, and the Vatican, and, convinced that Hitler was trying to make the most of them, took stern measures to counter them. Informed that the German chargé in Washington, Thompson, had been attempting to talk with the British ambassador there, he cabled that Lord Lothian should be told on no account to make any reply to the German chargé d'affaires message. To the King of Sweden, who had urged Great Britain to accept a peace settlement, the grim Prime Minister drafted a strong reply. Before any such requests or proposals could even be considered, it would be necessary that effective guarantees by deeds, not words, should be forthcoming from Germany, which would ensure the restoration of the free and independent life of Czechoslovakia, Poland, Norway, Denmark, Holland, Belgium, and above all, France. There are in the DGFP volumes several dispatches to the German Foreign Office about alleged contacts with various British diplomats and personages, sometimes direct, sometimes through neutrals, such as the Franco-Spaniards. Prince Max von Hohenlohe, the Sudeten-German Anglophile, reported to Berlin on his conversations with the British minister in Switzerland, Sir David Kelly, and with the Aga Khan. He claimed the latter had asked him to relay the following message to the Führer. The Khedive of Egypt, who is also here, had agreed with him that on the day when the Führer puts up for the night in Windsor, they would drink a bottle of champagne together. If Germany or Italy were thinking of taking over India, he would place himself at our disposal. The struggle against England was not a struggle against the English people, but against the Jews. Churchill had been for years in their pay, and the king was too weak and limited. If he were to go with these ideas to England, Churchill would lock him up. DGFP, Volume 10, pages 294 to 295. It must be kept in mind that these are German reports and may not be true at all, but they are what Hitler had to go on. The Nazi plan to enlist the Duke of Windsor, indeed the plot to kidnap him and then try to use him, as disclosed in the Foreign Office secret papers, is noted later. That was the nub of Churchill's case, and apparently no one in London dreamt of compromising it by concluding a peace that would preserve Britain but permanently enslave the countries Hitler had conquered. But this was not comprehended in Berlin, where, as I recall those summer days, everyone, especially in the Wilhelmstrasse and the Bendlerstrasse, was confident that the war was as good as over. All through the last fortnight of June and the first days of July, Hitler waited for word from London that the British government was ready to throw in the sponge and conclude peace. On July 1st, he told the new Italian ambassador, Dino Alfieri — Attolico had been replaced by Alfieri at the instigation of Ribbentrop in May — that he could not conceive of anyone in England still seriously believing in victory. Nothing had been done in the high command about continuing the war against Britain. But the next day, July 2nd, the first directive on that subject was finally issued by OKW. It was a hesitant order. "The Führer and Supreme Commander has decided that a landing in England is possible, providing that air superiority can be attained and certain other necessary conditions fulfilled. The date of commencement is still undecided. All preparations to be begun immediately." Hitler's lukewarm feeling about the operation and his belief that it would not be necessary is reflected in the concluding paragraph of the directive. "All preparations must be undertaken on the basis that the invasion is still only a plan and has not yet been decided upon." When Ciano saw the Führer in Berlin on July 7th, he got the impression, as he noted in his diary, that the Nazi warlord was having trouble making up his mind. "He is rather inclined to continue the struggle and to unleash a storm of wrath and of steel upon the English, but the final decision has not been reached, and it is for this reason that he is delaying his speech, of which, as he himself puts it, he wants to weigh every word." On July 11th, Hitler began assembling his military chiefs on the Obersalzberg to see how they felt about the matter. Admiral Raeder, whose navy would have to ferry an invading army across the Channel, had a long talk with the Führer on that date. Neither of them was eager to come to grips with the problem. In fact, they spent most of their time together discussing the matter of developing the naval bases at Trondheim and Narvik in Norway. The Supreme Commander, judging by Raeder's confidential report of the meeting, was in a subdued mood. He asked the admiral whether he thought his planned speech to the Reichstag would be effective. Raeder replied that it would be, especially if it were preceded by a concentrated bombing attack on Britain. The admiral, who reminded his chief that the RAF was carrying out damaging attacks on the principal German naval bases at Wilhelmshaven, Hamburg, and Kiel, thought the Luftwaffe ought to get busy immediately on Britain. But on the question of invasion, the Navy Commander-in-Chief was distinctly cool. He urgently advised that it be attempted only as a last resort to force Britain to sue for peace. "He," Raeder, "is convinced that Britain can be made to ask for peace simply by cutting off her import trade by means of submarine warfare, air attacks on convoys, and heavy air attacks on her main centers. The CNC Navy," Raeder, "cannot for his part therefore advocate an invasion of Britain as he did in the case of Norway." Whereupon the admiral launched into a long and detailed explanation of all the difficulties involved in such an invasion, which must have been most discouraging to Hitler. Discouraging, but perhaps also convincing. For Raeder reports that the Führer also views invasion as a last resort. 2 days later, on July 13th, the generals arrived at the Berghof above Berchtesgaden to confer with the Supreme Commander. They found him still baffled by the British. "The Führer," Halder jotted in his diary that evening, "is obsessed with the question why England does not yet want to take the road to peace." But now, for the first time, one of the reasons had begun to dawn on him. Halder noted it. "He sees, just as we do, the solution of this question in the fact that England is still setting her hope in Russia. Thus he too expects that England will have to be compelled by force to make peace. He does not like to do such a thing, however. Reasons? If we smash England militarily, the British Empire will disintegrate. Germany, however, would not profit from this. With German blood, we would achieve something from which only Japan, America, and others will derive profit. On the same day, July 13th, Hitler wrote Mussolini, declining with thanks the Duce's offer to furnish Italian troops and aircraft for the invasion of Britain. It is clear from this letter that the Führer was at last beginning to make up his mind. The strange British simply wouldn't listen to reason. "I have made to Britain so many offers of agreement, even of cooperation, and have been treated so shabbily," he wrote, "that I am now convinced that any new appeal to reason would meet with a similar rejection. For in that country at present it is not reason that rules." 3 days later, on July 16th, the warlord finally reached a decision. He issued Directive No. 16 on the preparation of a landing operation against England. Top Secret. Führer's Headquarters, July 16th, 1940. Since England, despite her militarily hopeless situation, still shows no sign of willingness to come to terms, I have decided to prepare a landing operation against England, and if necessary, to carry it out. The aim of this operation is to eliminate the English homeland as a base for the carrying on of the war against Germany, and, if it should become necessary, to occupy it completely. The code name for the assault was to be Sea Lion. Preparations for it were to be completed by mid-August. If necessary to carry it out. Despite his growing instinct that it would be necessary, he was not quite sure, as the directive shows. The if was still a big one as Adolf Hitler rose in the Reichstag on the evening of July 19th to make his final peace offer to Britain. It was the last of his great Reichstag speeches and the last of so many in this place down the years that this writer would hear. It was also one of his best. I put down my impressions of it that same evening. "The Hitler we saw in the Reichstag tonight was the conqueror, and conscious of it, and yet so wonderful an actor, so magnificent a handler of the German mind, that he mixed superbly the full confidence of the conqueror with the humbleness which always goes down so well with the masses when they know a man is on top. His voice was lower tonight. He rarely shouted as he usually does, and he did not once cry out hysterically as I've seen him do so often from this rostrum." To be sure, his long speech was swollen with falsifications of history and liberally sprinkled with personal insults of Churchill, but it was moderate in tone, considering the glittering circumstances, and shrewdly conceived to win the support not only of his own people, but of the neutrals, and to give the masses in England something to think about. "From Britain," he said, "I now hear only a single cry, not of the people, but of the politicians, that the war must go on. I do not know whether these politicians already have a correct idea of what the continuation of this struggle will be like. They do, it is true, declare that they will carry on with the war, and that even if Great Britain should perish, they would carry on from Canada. I can hardly believe that they mean by this that the people of Britain are to go to Canada. Presumably only those gentlemen interested in the continuation of their war will go there. The people, I am afraid, will have to remain in Britain, and will certainly regard the war with other eyes than their so-called leaders in Canada. Believe me, gentlemen, I feel a deep disgust for this type of unscrupulous politician who wrecks whole nations. It almost causes me pain to think that I should have been selected by fate to deal the final blow to the structure which these men have already set tottering. Mr. Churchill, no doubt, will already be in Canada, where the money and children of those principally interested in the war have already been sent. For millions of other people, however, great suffering will begin. Mr. Churchill ought, perhaps for once, to believe me when I prophesy that a great empire will be destroyed, an empire which it was never my intention to destroy or even to harm." Having thus tilted at the dogged Prime Minister and attempted to detach the British people from him, Hitler came to the point of his lengthy speech. "In this hour I feel it to be my duty before my own conscience to appeal once more to reason and common sense in Great Britain as much as elsewhere. I consider myself in a position to make this appeal, since I am not the vanquished begging favors, but the victor speaking in the name of reason. I can see no reason why this war must go on." There was a colorful scene, and one unprecedented in German history, when Hitler suddenly broke off his speech in the middle to award field marshals' batons to 12 generals, and a special king-size one to Goering, who was given the newly created rank of Reich Marshal of the Greater German Reich, which put him above all the others. He was also awarded the Grand Cross of the Iron Cross, the only one given during the entire war. Halder was passed over in this avalanche of Field Marshal awards, being merely promoted one grade from Lieutenant General to General. This promiscuous award of Field Marshalships, the Kaiser had named only 5 Field Marshals from the Officer Corps during all of World War I, and not even Ludendorff had been made one, undoubtedly helped to stifle any latent opposition to Hitler among the generals, such as had threatened to remove him on at least 3 occasions in the past. In achieving this and in debasing the value of the highest military rank by raising so many to it, Hitler acted shrewdly to tighten his hold over the generals. 9 army generals were promoted to field marshal: Brauchitsch, Keitel, Rundstedt, Bock, Leib, Liszt, Kluge, Witzleben, and Reichenau, and 3 Luftwaffe officers: Milch, Kesselring, and Sperle. He was not more specific than that. He made no concrete suggestions for peace terms, no mention of what was to happen to the 100 million people now under the Nazi yoke in the conquered countries. But there were few, if any, in the Reichstag that evening who believed that it was necessary at this stage to go into the details. I mingled with a good many officials and officers at the close of the session, and not one of them had the slightest doubt, as they said, that the British would accept what they really believed was a very generous and even magnanimous offer from the Führer. They were not for long to be deceived. I drove directly to the Rundfunk to make a broadcast report of the speech to the United States. I had hardly arrived at Broadcasting House when I picked up a BBC broadcast in German from London. It was giving the British answer to Hitler already, within the hour. It was a determined no. Churchill later declared that this immediate and brusque rejection of Hitler's peace offer was made by the BBC without any prompting from His Majesty's government as soon as Hitler's speech was heard over the radio. Churchill, Their Finest Hour, page 260. Junior officers from the High Command and officials from various ministries were sitting around the room listening with rapt attention. Their faces fell. They could not believe their ears. "Can you make it out?" one of them shouted to me. He seemed dazed. "Can you understand those British fools?" he continued to bellow. "To turn down peace now? They're crazy." The same evening, Chano heard the reaction to the crazy English on a much higher level in Berlin than mine. The Italian foreign minister had behaved like a clown during the Reichstag session, bobbing up and down like a jack-in-the-box to give the fascist salute every time Hitler paused for breath. I also noticed Quisling, a pig-eyed little man crouching in a corner seat in the first balcony. He had come to Berlin to beg the Führer to reinstate him in power in Oslo. Late in the evening, Chano noted in his diary, when the first cold English reactions to the speech arrive, a sense of ill-concealed disappointment spreads among the Germans. The effect on Mussolini, according to Chano, was just the opposite. He defines it a much too cunning speech. He fears that the English may find in it a pretext to begin negotiations. That would be sad for Mussolini, because now more than ever he wants war. The Duce, as Churchill later remarked, need not have fretted himself. He was not to be denied all the war he wanted. As a maneuver calculated to rally the German people for the fight against Britain, I wrote in my diary that night, Hitler's speech was a masterpiece, for the German people will now say, Hitler offers England peace and no strings attached. He says he sees no reason why this war should go on. If it does, it's England's fault. And was that not the principal reason for giving it 3 days after he had issued Directive No. 16 to prepare the invasion of Britain? He admitted as much, beforehand, to 2 Italian confidants, Alfieri and Chano. On July 1st, he had told the ambassador, "It was always a good tactic to make the enemy responsible in the eyes of public opinion in Germany and abroad for the future course of events. This strengthened one's own morale and weakened that of the enemy. An operation such as the one Germany was planning would be very bloody. Therefore, one must convince public opinion that everything had first been done to avoid this horror." In his speech of October 6th, when he had offered peace to the West at the conclusion of the Polish campaign, he had likewise been guided by the thought of making the opposing side responsible for all subsequent developments. He had thereby won the war, as it were, before it had really started. Now again he intended, for psychological reasons, to buttress morale, so to speak, for the action about to be taken. A week later, on July 8th, Hitler confided to Chano that he would stage another demonstration so that in case the war should continue, which he thought was the only real possibility that came into question, he might achieve a psychological effect among the English people. Perhaps it would be possible by a skillful appeal to the English people to isolate the English government still further in England. It did not prove possible. The speech of July 19th worked with the German people, but not with the British. On July 22nd, Lord Halifax, in a broadcast, made the rejection of Hitler's peace offer official. Though it had been expected, it somehow jolted the Wilhelmstrasse, where I found many angry faces that afternoon. "Lord Halifax," the official government spokesman told us, "has refused to accept the peace offer of the Führer. Gentlemen, there will be war." It was easier said than done. In truth, neither Hitler, the High Command, nor the General Staffs of the Army, Navy, and Air Force had ever seriously considered how a war with Great Britain could be fought and won. Now, in the midsummer of 1940, they did not know what to do with their glittering success. They had no plans and scarcely any will for exploiting the greatest military victories in the history of their soldiering nation. This is one of the great paradoxes of the Third Reich. At the very moment when Hitler stood at the zenith of his military power, with most of the European continent at his feet, his victorious armies stretched from the Pyrenees to the Arctic Circle, from the Atlantic to beyond the Vistula, rested now and ready for further action, he had no idea how to go on and bring the war to a victorious conclusion. Nor had his generals, 12 of whom now bandied field marshals' batons. There is, of course, a reason for this, although it was not clear to us at the time. The Germans, despite their vaunted military talents, lacked any grand strategic concept. Their horizons were limited, they had always been limited, to land warfare against the neighboring nations on the European continent. Hitler himself had a horror of the sea. "On land I am a hero, but on water I am a coward," he told Rundstedt once. Schulman, Defeat in the West, page 50. And his great captains almost a total ignorance of it. They were land-minded, not sea-minded, and though their armies could have crushed in a week the feeble land forces of Britain if they had only been able to come to grips with them, even the narrow waters of the Dover Straits which separated the two, so narrow that you can see across to the opposite shore, loomed in their minds, as the splendid summer began to wane, as an obstacle they knew not how to overcome. There was, of course, another alternative open to the Germans. They might bring Britain down by striking across the Mediterranean with their Italian ally, taking Gibraltar at its western opening, and in the east, driving on from Italy's bases in North Africa, through Egypt, and over the canal to Iran, severing one of the empire's main lifelines. But this necessitated vast operations overseas at distances far from home bases, and in 1940 it seemed beyond the scope of the German imagination. Thus, at the height of dizzy success, Hitler and his captains hesitated. They had not thought out the next step and how it was to be carried through. This fateful neglect would prove to be one of the great turning points of the war, and indeed of the short life of the Third Reich and of the meteoric career of Adolf Hitler. Failure, after so many stupendous victories, was now to set in. But this, to be sure, could not be foreseen as beleaguered Britain, now holding out alone, girded herself with what small means she had for the German onslaught at the summer's end.